A Motorsport Podcast Network production.
Welcome to Rally Sport Magazine's Dust Trails podcast. Dust Trails is where we go in depth with some of rallying's biggest names. Be sure to check out the back catalogue, available now for names like Chris Atkinson, Ross Dunkerton and Wayne Bell. There's almost 30 there for you to listen to now. This episode of Dust Trails focuses on the most famous voice in world rallying, Scotsman Colin Clark. He joins our Dust Trails podcast for an in-depth chat on all things rallying. In part one, Colin recalls his first taste of rallying when he was working for the 555 cigarette brand as part of the Subaru World Rally team. He progressed then into a stage end reporter for the much-missed Rally Radio. Our chat includes in-depth details about his rare crash with Aussie star Brendan Reeves, some of his favourite moments in the World Rally Championship, and the sad demise of Rally Radio. We finish part one by asking about his popular kitchen table video series and ask if we're likely to see a return to them anytime soon. We hope you enjoy it.
Welcome to another episode of Rally Sport Magazine's Dust Trails podcast. And with us this morning is Colin Clark, one of the most recognisable voices in world rallying. G'day, Colin. How are you doing?
Morning, Pete. Yeah, really quite good, thank you. Thank you for the early morning call-ish.
Yeah. Well, it turns out that you're in Australia at the moment, but you're just about to set off on a bit of a round-the-world tour as usual.
Well, it's kind of halfway of a round-the-world tour. Sweden. I was Rally Sweden and then more or less straight to Mexico for the Rally of Nations. Out here to do some stuff on the Heartland Rally and then home via St. Louis, wherever that is. St. Louis, Missouri, I think in the States for the 100-acre woods, and then off to safari. So yeah, it's a world tour of rallying. It's not a bad way to earn a few quid, is it?
It's not a bad way. And it's always good when there's rallies on the calendar coming forward, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's absolutely the way it is. Yeah, so yeah, no, I'm not complaining. But I was having the best night's sleep I have had in months until your text pinged in. So I'll not hold that against you, Pete. You're all right. We'll forgive you that one. It's always worth it to talk rallying.
Well, and I know how you love early mornings, Cole. So we're sorry to wake you up.
Yeah, no, I don't mind early mornings as long as there's a coffee. So there was a slight moment of panic. Because I'll confess, I had slightly forgotten that I was doing this with you this morning. So when the text pinged in, it was like, I can't talk to Pete without a coffee. So I sent you a note saying I might be a couple of minutes late, round to the coffee shop. I've got my jumbo latte, which I think has 4 shots in it. So I'm all good. I'm all good, Pete. I'm all ready to go.
Bouncing off the wall. So let's get into it, Cole. So yeah. For those who don't know, your rallying career, I guess, if for want of a better term, was pretty out of the blue, really, because you weren't a motorsport person.
No, I wasn't. I wasn't a motorsport person. Listen, our family was very much a sporting family, and there weren't many sports on the telly at the weekend that we wouldn't watch and we wouldn't follow. And obviously, you know, motorsport was part of that. But we loved our football, we loved our golf, we were big hockey players in my family, field hockey. But motorsport was all part of that mix. You'd watch the Grand Prix on a Sunday and fall asleep to them. You know, in the UK, we would get an hour's coverage on the BBC of the World Rally Championship, maybe 2 or 3 weeks after each rally on a Saturday lunchtime. And certainly in the 80s, I would watch that. But no, I wouldn't have called myself a rally fan at all. But I worked when I left university for a tobacco company and worked my way through the ranks at this tobacco company and somehow found myself in charge of sponsorship and promotions. And we, in 2002, went back on the side of the Subaru World Rally Team's car with the 555 brand again. And that's really how my passion for rallying started. I got a phone call. I remember it was around about the 15th of December, saying that our global marketing director had been out to dinner with David Richards from ProDrive. And we were going back on the side of the car. It was a three-year deal, and it was going to be announced to the company the week before Christmas, which I had to arrange. And then we were going to be in Monte Carlo for the first event, and I had to sort all that out as well. So it was chucked in at the deep end. But, you know, I'd have to say from the very first moment, I was excited by it, and I loved it. I absolutely loved it.
So the drivers back in 2002, I'm trying to think back, it was probably Richard Burns and Tommy McAnally.
No, no. Well, it was supposed to be Richard, wasn't it? But poor Richard was taken ill. So it was Petter, it was Tommy, and it was Toshi? I think it was Toshi. Toshi Arai was the third driver, I think, in 2002. So I got to know them well, and I got to know them because strangely, Tommy liked his cigars. He liked his celebratory cigars. And we had at BAT, or at Rothmans as it was at the time. Actually, no, it was BAT. We'd merged at that point. We had this incredible cigar room, a humidor, and it was a massive room in the head office. And it had all sorts of really, really, really kind of luxury top-end cigars in it. And I'd never had access to it. I knew it was there, but I didn't have access to it. And I found out that Tommy liked cigars. So I thought it would be nice to take my box of cigars at each event that I went along to. So I would go in and speak to the cigar guys, and they would go to the very top shelf. And it was a bit like the wines. You know, the higher up you go, the more expensive they get. So the very top shelf, and he would bring me down this box. And the first rally I went to, Petter went, "Where is my box? Where is my box of cigars?" I'm thinking, you're too young to smoke cigars. So we started taking along, you know, two boxes of cigars to every event, one for Tommy and one for Petter. And these cigars, they were something like $1,000 for three of them. They were enormously expensive. And I was actually talking to Petter the other week, right, probably 6 months ago now. And he said, you know what? I did smoke some of them, but I found a box of them just a few weeks ago in the house that I had not used. I said, geez, they'll be like sawdust now. He said, yeah, I put them in the bin. They were awful. And I'm thinking, oh, dear, oh, dear. So I got to know the boys quite well from that. You're taking along. I was the cigar man, basically, not the cigarette man.
And how was your transition into rallying? Because obviously, if you didn't know heaps about it, and suddenly you're working at the top of the tree, must have been a bit of a process to get your head around everything.
Well, you know what? A little bit, but I was a fan, and that was it. And I think that kind of, you know, transitioned into my time in media. I've always just been a fan. It was great because I was getting to learn all about a new sport from the very best place. You know, I'm right at the heart of it, right in the center of it. You know, at the time, the most successful team, one of the most successful teams there, with, you know, the most charismatic driver, he was four or five times World Rally Champion. It was a great place to learn about the sport. You know, the first experience of spectating I had was on the Col di Torino in a helicopter with Paddy Hopkirk. It doesn't get much better, does it? You know, I'm in a helicopter and I'm chatting away to this little Irishman who's next to me, yabbering away. And it was great. We had the helicopter for the whole morning. I'd never been in a helicopter in my life. And this thing's bumping up and down on the thermals. And I'm thinking, no, I'm not liking this. And the wee Irishman next to me, he's going, oh, don't worry about it. It's perfectly normal. Chatting away to him. And we eventually find somewhere to land because all the landing spots are taken. And he's chattering away. And I told him I'd never been spectating before. And he's telling me all about the cars and the drivers and the lines they're taking. And eventually I said to him, I said, you seem to know an awful lot about this sport. He's like, yeah, I've driven a little bit before. I went, okay. And we chatted on a bit more. And eventually said, yeah, I've won this event. And it was Paddy Hopkirk. And I'd spent the first hour or two of my spectating career chatting away to a legend, a total legend, Paddy Hopkirk. And he was just the nicest man. And yeah, it was an incredible introduction. That whole week was just an incredible introduction to rallying for me. And it never, you can imagine how that could spark someone's passion. You know, there's no better way to spark a passion, really.
No, totally. And how long were you with the Subaru team? Was it right until the end of the 2008 season?
No. It was all very odd. The whole Subaru deal was very strange. Obviously we'd had the glory days in the 90s where it was a huge sponsorship in the 90s that delivered world championships and all the rest. And that was nothing to do with me. But the 2002 deal came about because, if you remember, David Richards was poached by British American Tobacco to run their Formula One team. Craig Pollock had been running the Formula One team for 3 years. And it was just a massive money pit. The story is it was $1 billion that BAT had spent, a billion. And this is 20 years ago, in 3 years. And Pollock and Jacques Villeneuve had delivered nothing in those 3 years. And the guy who ran the company effectively, the marketing director, he was probably one of the scariest men I've ever met. The only man I've ever seen David Richards deferring to and actually looking quite nervous in the presence of. David Richards is nervous around no one, but he was almost nervous in this man's presence. He was so intimidating. But he basically said at the end of 2001, I want David Richards to run my Formula One team. And he did a deal with David, and David took the whole of the ProDrive management. So everyone who was running the rally team basically moved 40 kilometers, 50 kilometers up the road to Brackley to run the Formula One team. And David, being David, was very, very clever. And they had this dinner just before Christmas. And it had all been signed off for the Formula One deal. And it was, I don't know the size of the Formula One deal, but it was massive, I'm sure. The deal was done for Formula One. And David went out to dinner with this very intimidating man. And he said to him, look, you know, it's all set. We'll be running the Formula One team next year. He said, but there's a small problem with my rally team. And allegedly this guy said, well, what do you mean? What's a rally team? He said, I've got this little rally team. We've enjoyed a little bit of success, but your biggest rival, Philip Morris, are on the verge of signing a very, very good deal to sponsor them. And that just won't look right, will it, if I'm looking after your Formula One team and your biggest rival is sponsoring the rally team? And this guy, Jimmy, we'll just call him Jimmy just now, he said, well, how much do you want? And David said, well, they're offering somewhere. He goes, it's many millions they're offering. Jimmy went, well, we'll just pay that. We'll pay that then. So that's how the second sponsorship from 2002, 2003, and 2004. That's how it came about. And that's when I get the phone call the next morning saying, right, we're going back on the side of the car. They had to find me first. There was no one in charge of that type of sponsorship. So they went, oh, we'll give that to Colin. He can look after that. They phoned me up and said, it's on again. Launch it internally, and then you're off to Monte Carlo with fives on the side of the car. So yeah, it was exciting times.
Quite incredible. So at what point did you make the transition from the corporate world, I guess, to the championship world and start working for WRC and doing rally radio?
Yeah, well, that was interesting as well. I can't tell all of this story, although I have told it before. I took redundancy, and there was a reason I took redundancy from the tobacco company. It was all coming to an end, your sponsorship and promotions in the tobacco industry. Anyone who was around tobacco in the 90s it's a massively conflicting and controversial industry. And you know what? I've never smoked and I've never encouraged anyone to smoke. I actually really dislike smoking, even although I worked for the company for 10 or 12 years. The British government had basically said the European government, there will be no more sponsorship, there will be no more promotions. And there was an opportunity for redundancy coming up. And I thought, well, that's my job gone. In fact, I'd been told my job had gone for another reason, nothing to do with me, technical reason. So I thought, well, I don't want to go back to brand marketing. I'll just take the redundancy. So I negotiated a very generous redundancy deal. I bought myself a 964 911 and semi-retired. Well, I hadn't had a company car in 10 years. And I'd not had my own car, private car. I'd always had a company car. And I got this big payoff and I said to Dad, I've got to go and buy a car. And I'm going to buy an Alfa Romeo, Dad. And he went, and we were an Alfa Romeo family. Dad loved his Alfa Romeos. He went, yeah, buy an Alfa Romeo. He said, but it'll be worth half in 12 months' time of what you pay for it. And I thought, I don't quite like that idea. I'm a Scotsman, that doesn't sound great to me. So he said, just buy yourself a Porsche. He said, you can't go wrong with a Porsche. He said, you'll always more or less get back what you paid for it. And it's the only car I've ever owned where I got more for it than I paid for it. And I owned it for 18 months. Yeah, and for me, that was like winning the lottery. It was the best car I ever owned. I just enjoyed driving that for 18 months and then thought, I've got to get back into working life. And wanted to get back into rallying somehow. Wasn't quite sure how. But thought, I've got to get back into rallying somehow because I absolutely loved the whole rally world and the rally environment. And I set up a website. I set up a website to sell ringtones. I don't know if you remember, Pete. I probably do because you're about my age. Ringtones were huge in the early 2000s. And there were people making bloody fortunes. I mean, millions and millions from ringtones. So I set up a site called speedtones.com. So it was genius. And if I'd stuck to it, I'd probably be a millionaire by now. you could go to my site, and if you wanted your Petter Solberg on the Call de Torini as your ringtone, you could download it for a couple of bucks. And it was, you know, so it was also, you could get, if you wanted a Ferrari going around the streets of Monte Carlo as your ringtone, you could have that as well. So the idea was, you know, if you were a motorsport fan and you wanted a motorsport ringtone, you go to speedtones.com and you download it for a few bucks. And away you go. And it was going to make me rich, quite clearly. It was going to make me the richest man on the planet.
Sure.
But then I got sidetracked. I realized I needed to actually obtain some of these ringtones. I needed to go and get some sounds. I didn't have the sounds. So I spoke to my mate George Donaldson, who was the sporting director at Subaru, and said, George, do you know anyone that might have some kit that I can use to record some sounds of cars? And he went, yeah, Greg Strange, the guy that runs Rally Radio, he's got some kit. And he said, it's Cyprus next. Why don't you come out to Cyprus? I'll have a chat with Greg. So he comes back to me and says, yeah, Greg's right up for it. You know, he'll lend you the kit. You can go and record the sounds at Shakedown, but he needs you to help him out. He's not got anyone to do any stage end interviewing. And I went, well, what's stage end interviewing? What does that involve? And he said, oh, it just involves standing at the end of the stage and talking to the drivers. And, you know, just at the time, just saying yes to everything, I went, yeah, I can do that. And then completely shit myself, to be honest. I thought, how am I going to do this? I've got no experience of reporting or anything. So I took my little brother along with me, who'd done a little bit of radio and public speaking and stuff before. I thought, if I can't do this, I'm just going to pass the kit to my brother and he can do it. He can, and we'll cover ourselves that way. And I remember it vividly, the end of the first stage. It was the roughest stage they'd had in the championship for years. And there were cars coming in with wheels hanging off, with suspension hanging off, with body panels damaged. It was just, the adrenaline buzz was just unreal. And that was it. It was like, nah, this is me. Forget about ringtones. This is what I want to do. And that was the start of it. That was Cyprus 2005. And it just went from there. You know, like anything, Pete, a lot of youngsters say, how'd you get into it? Well, you got to put some effort into it. You know, I did that whole year for nothing. I didn't get paid anything for that whole year. And it wasn't until the next year that I felt in a position where I could actually say, look, you know, you're going to have to start paying me for doing this. And then worked hard from there. You can't ever stand still. I've never just been a radio reporter. You know, I learned how to edit, how to shoot, how to put things together, worked hard at building relationships. There was a time when I remember Rally GB one year, I was making videos for, I think it was 8 different drivers, you know, between me and a little crew I had. So, you know, you just kept moving on, and that's what I did. Just kept moving on and just trying to just deliver what people want. You know, it's not always, you can't always deliver what people want. It's impossible to be, you know, popular or doing the right thing for everyone. You know, if you're boring and you're dull, people don't talk about you. Well, maybe you might think that way. You might think that you're doing the right thing, but that's not me. As I said at the start, I'm a fan, and you know, and I always think that rallying is, particularly stage ends, you know, it's the greatest sport, and stage ends are just totally unique to rally.
Yeah.
And the atmosphere there is phenomenal. And I, you know, it's just, if you don't get excited by that, you're not going to get excited by anything in life.
And we'll get into that in a moment, but those rally radio days, they were really iconic. And my first memories of it, I guess, I mean, because I'd been used to growing up and obviously reading a report a couple of weeks after an event, or then coming into the fax days, you'd go to the fax machine the morning after a rally and see who was leading. But then suddenly we were actually able to tune in and listen once the internet came on board. And the technology involved, even back then in the, I guess, the early to mid-2000s, must have been pretty incredible.
Surprisingly not, Pete. It was all quite basic. It was all quite basic, but always a bit of a trial. We were basically, I was at the end of the stage connected via telephone line. Effectively to London. If it was in London, the studio, actually the studio was in North Wales for a while, and Bex was in the service park, and she was connected via, hers wasn't a telephone line, she was it was an internet connection back to the studio. And the studio in London basically anchored everything, and Bex in the service park, me at the stage end, and we fed in and it's, you know, I mean, I remember standing at stage ends with a fishing pole with an extendable aerial strapped to the top of the fishing pole to get better cell phone coverage. And it worked. It really did work. But I'd be striding around the stage end with this fishing pole that's like 10 foot in the air, just resting on my shoulder, and then ducking into cars with a fishing pole bobbing around everywhere. It was fairly straightforward. And that's, in some ways, that kept it real. You know, we would go to Finland and we would go to Sweden, and they would have satellite vans at the end of every stage for their rally radio. And their rally radio was very good, very, very good, and very entertaining and informative, which is what it's got to be. But it was almost too polished, you know. You want that little bit of kind of, you know, that roughness that you get from a telephone call that says, yeah, we're in the middle of nowhere, because that's where we were most of the time, in the middle of nowhere, reporting on just incredible things going on. So it was reasonably straightforward. But there was just something that worked about it. I remember that the guys at Autosport wrote an article about it, saying it shouldn't work. It shouldn't work. The concept of rally radio shouldn't really work. You know, they can't see any cars. They can't see any action. They only really get to speak to the drivers for a minute or two in every hour. It shouldn't work, but it does work. And it did. It did. We had a really big, loyal listenership that would take us with them everywhere they went. They would go on a Friday, they would go to work and they would have us with them at work. They would have their Friday evening beers and they would have us almost on at the pub in the Friday evening, shopping on the Saturday, and they'd have us with us on the Saturday, Sunday morning cutting the grass, and they'd have us in their ears listening to us on Saturday, Sunday morning. And, you know, it was incredible. And that was the great thing about radio. You know, it was completely mobile, and you could duck in and duck out whenever you wanted and enjoy it. And we always tried to make it interesting, and you didn't have to try too hard because it always was interesting, and fun and exciting. And yeah, okay. You know, if there's even a slightest hint of drama, then I'm going to jump on it and seize it and turn it into the world's biggest drama. But people seem to enjoy that. And it was great fun. Great fun. There were great days.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about some of those moments too, because I guess firstly, my first experience when I came across you was, I think, at 2005 Rally Australia at the end of the last stage, just out of Mundaring, when Francois Duval when he won his first event, and just listening to the passion in your voice at the end of that stage as you talked about Duval coming up to the finish control. I mean, it was just a remarkable situation.
It was. And you know what I'll always remember that for? I loved that. I loved, particularly when young drivers won for the first time. You know, there was tremendous emotion and there's tremendous excitement and tremendous drama. And radio was very different. You know, before I started doing the radio, you know, I'd worked for a tobacco company and I'd spent an awful lot of time in my car driving to work. I was nearly 200 kilometers from my office, was where I lived. So I'd spend a lot of time in the car in the morning driving to work. And I used to listen to radio. And I listened to a lot of sport radio, particularly cricket. And what they did with cricket on the BBC is they combined this unbelievable expertise. And these people were, they weren't just expert. They were, you completely trusted them. You completely believed them. And they could paint a wonderful picture of what was going on. But, you know, in between each ball, in between each over, it was entertaining. They would talk about the pigeons. They would talk about the buses. They would talk about the cakes. They would talk about all sorts of things. But you know, when the moment called for it, there was incredible intensity. There was incredible knowledge. There was real, real valued insights. And you know, you felt you were there with the cricket team. And that's the only real training I had to do what I did at Stage Ends. I thought, yeah, I they would take me to wherever they were, whether it was, you know, Sydney Cricket Ground, whether it was the Oval, whether it was, you know, somewhere in Peshawar, wherever it was, they would take you there. And it was incredible. And I thought, that's my job. My job is to take the listeners. I'm fortunate. I'm the one who is standing at the end of that stage in Perth. I'm the one that's standing in the middle of nowhere in Argentina. And these people are back home in their houses. You know, they're enjoying a break from everyday life. I have to take them along on this journey. And the best moments for me were moments like the one you're talking about there in 2005 with Duval. It was completely just, you know, off the moment. You know, I got quite excited at times, but I got excited because the moment deserved that level of excitement. The moment induced that level of excitement. The moment, you know, was exciting and it was incredible. And you've got a young driver who, you know, has got quite a checkered history. Had he been sacked at that point by Citroën? He'd been sacked for Carlos Sainz. He had earlier in the year, hadn't he? Mm. He'd been dropped for Carlos Sainz. I think it was Cyprus. He set the hillside on fire. Citroën dropped him, and he made a ridiculous mistake. It was a catastrophic mistake. He turned down a multi-year deal with M Sport to take this deal with Citroën because, you know, Duval thought he could beat Loeb, and given the same car, he would beat him. And there was just an incredible backstory to Duval. One of the great underachievers, in my view, in World Rally, could have done so much more. So that moment as he comes in there, yeah, it was exciting. And I remember getting dead excited. And I remember talking to Julian Porter because, you know, the excitement just slightly peters off and you're expecting them to get out the car and to celebrate. You know, this is a young man who's faced all sorts of criticism, all sorts of diversity. And at last, he's won around the World Rally Championship. You think, yeah, you know, what do? They get out, they get on top of the car, they show your real emotion. None of that. None of that from Duval. He had to be coaxed out of the car. Julian went, do you think I should try and get him out of the car? I went, yeah, get him out of the car. You know, and it was just bizarre. It was just utterly bizarre. Duval was a bit of an enigma. But that moment I'll never forget just because of this, like, he's just, you would imagine, he's just achieved a lifetime goal, a lifetime dream to win a world of the rally, a round of the World Rally Championship. And he's just sitting in his car as if he's, you know, arrived at Costco to buy the weekly shopping. It was bizarre, quite bizarre.
It certainly was. Another one, Rally Australia based, and this time over at Coffs Harbour, was when you jumped in the car with Brendan Reeves pre-event.
Oh, thanks, mate.
And that was pretty much broadcast live as well, wasn't it?
Oh, you've re-traumatized me all over again. Yeah, that was just totally bizarre. That was totally. Listen, I'm a reasonably spiritual person, but, you know, there was something telling me not to get in that car all week. Something was telling me, and Brendo kept calling me up. So it was quite different. So it was the Australian Rally Championship. It was a great stage. It was Wedding Bells, wasn't it?
Yes.
I think it was the Wedding Bells stage. And with the Australian Championship, they would have their power stage before the rally, which was a little bizarre, before the rally had started. So it was, I think it was Thursday morning, and they'd had their power stage, and Brendo had won it, and he'd been along this stage about six or seven times. And we'd had shakedown down in Coffs, and he called me again. He'd been calling me all week. Come on, Cole, come for a drive. So I was with a cameraman at the time, an Aussie guy, great guy, really great Aussie. And all, a guy that makes surf movies, and I worked with him for a little while, really super guy. And he said, oh, come on, Cole, we'll just go up. We've got nothing to do. Shakedown's finished. It's only 20 minutes up the road. Let's go. So we go up to Wedding Bells, and Brendo's there with his now wife. He said, right, jump in the car, Cole, and we'll go and we'll make a little film of this. So, you know, we do it, and it's piece to camera and getting in the car. And I said I was nervous. I'd been in a car once before with a young driver, and he'd scared the crap out of me. And he'd scared the crap out of me because he wasn't very good. And it was in Finland. And I remember at the time saying to him, stop halfway through the stage. I'm getting out of this car. And then he drove more sensibly. So I was a little bit nervous when I got in the car. I was recounting this story. But we get in, and away we go at the start line, and off we go down this stage. And you know, it's a very fast stage, and it's lined by enormous trees. Very fast, number of jumps. And we're probably two-thirds of the way through, and we've gone over a couple of jumps. And I knew, as we come over this last jump into quite a fast left-hander, this ain't going well. We're going off here. And we did. And we hit the bank, and the car jumped up and spun around and crashed and all the rest. And we were quite lucky. We were really quite lucky. There was only damage to the suspension, and we were both okay. We eventually get back to the service point, and I'm shaking my head, and I said to my cameraman, my Aussie boy, I said, look, you know, I knew something was going to happen. You know, I didn't want to do that. And he went, Cole, as you drove off there, I knew you were going to crash. I went, why didn't you tell me? Because I knew we were going to crash as well. And it was one of those very strange situations where, you know, and Brendan Reeves never crashes. He is the safest driver. He's had one, sadly, really bad crash in his career. It was Brendan and his sister in the car, and they both recovered after quite a while. They both recovered well. But Brendo is the safest, the best driver that Australia has produced for many, many years. And it was just one of those unfortunate moments. But my cameraman knew we were going to crash, and I knew we were going to crash. Explain that one, Pete. That was very strange.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, sometimes.
But it's all on video. You can watch it if you Google it. Or you go onto YouTube and put Colin Clark crash. It'll be there for you to enjoy.
Let's jump back to the end of some stages and some iconic moments, certainly from my memories. The end of On Empoyer 2016, Chris Meek.
Yeah, Chris Meek.
16 seconds faster than anybody else.
It was astonishing. It was early Saturday morning, I think, wasn't it?
Yes.
It was early. Was it Sunday? It would have been Saturday. Early Saturday morning, first pass. And Latvala had come through with a really quick time. I can't remember how it all transpired, but Mick came through, and it was you're questioning it, and I've spoken to Paul Nagel about it constantly, subsequently, and he said, I said to him, when did you know the time was good? Did it feel good in the car? He said, Carl, I knew it was good when we came through the flying finish, and I could see you, and you were jumping up and down like a lunatic. He said, at that point, I knew we've done something a bit special in here. But it was just incredible. You know, things just clicked for Chris Meek in that stage. And you know, when you beat Jari Matti Latvala, who was pretty much at the top of his game at the time, in the best car, without any question. And when you beat him by that margin, you're doing something right. And Meek just got every corner, every breaking point, every crest, absolutely perfect. Absolutely perfect in that stage. And it was astonishing. And Meek had that ability. And there haven't been many drivers in recent history, certainly in the last 20 years, that had the ability to do that. Meek was one. And strangely, Latvala was another who could, you know, just pull something out of the bag, which was astonishing. You know, 2 or 3 seconds a stage, yeah, lots of drivers. And that's how guys like Loeb and Ogier, you know, they were consistently 2 or 3 seconds a stage quicker. But the likes of Meek, the likes of Latvala could just occasionally just pull something remarkable out of the bag and beat everyone by 10 seconds or 15 seconds or whatever. And that was one of those mornings. And it was incredible. It was just incredible to witness it.
That's one of those moments too that Rally Radio brought to the people, yeah. Like you said. I mean, back here in Australia, it was Saturday evening, I think. We were sitting out the back around a fire, middle of winter, trying to keep warm, just having a nice Saturday evening and listening to you bring the life of that stage through to us via the radio was just incredible.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, sometimes you would be at the end of the stages, and you would you know, Sunday afternoon the rally's all done, and you think, oh my god, that was just the most intense drama, just incredible. And Rally Germany was one year where we did that. I think it was where both Sordo and Neuville were battling for the win on the final day, and I think Sordo took his first win, didn't he? Or was it Neuville? Yes. It was Sordo took the win. I've never known drama like it. And then you watch the TV program and you think, either I was at a different rally or they were at a different rally. You know, we could convey, and you know, put my hands up and say it's not quite so easy to convey drama and tension and excitement and all of those things on TV. Sometimes it's a bit more difficult, maybe a touch more straightforward on radio. And when you're there in person, but you know, it did astonish me that at times, you know, we were in the middle of the most intense dramas, and then you'd watch it back on the telly and think, what? How did they miss that? You know, how did they miss the drama and all the rest? And that was one of them. You know, that Sordo Neuville battle on the final day, which was just incredible. But you know, radio did have a way because it was immediate. Because you had to describe what was going on. You had to live the moment for the listeners. And you know, if like me, you were actually passionate about not just the sport, but the people in the sport, the places we went to, you know, the history of the sport, the DNA of the sport, passionate about all those things, then you can hopefully convey it. And I think we managed to do that. And it's been an issue for I suppose the people who have made the TV for years now is how you get that kind of that drama and that tension and that passion across in a TV program. And, you know, we could do it with the radio. And I think that's why radio is still much missed by many, many people.
Of course. And similarly with another event with Hayden Paddon winning at Rally Argentina in 2016, end of the last stage. And from my memory, you weren't even at the finish of the stage.
I'm trying to think where I was.
I think you're up on top of the hill trying to get reception or something along those lines.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. So I was there when Meek won. Meek was at the end of the El Condor stage.
Yeah.
With Paddon, you could well be right. I might not have been.
I think you could see the stop point from where you were standing as you were trying to get reception.
Yeah, that was another place where I had the fishing rods, the fishing pole, and the aerial on top of the fishing pole, where it was just. The problem there wasn't so much you know, actually getting reception. It was the fact there was, you know, 150,000 people, you know, all the way down a 20-kilometer stage. There were so many people on that stage. But, yeah, you know, there were some great moments. Paddon's victory, you know, Meek's victory there. You know, some really great moments. You mentioned Finland where obviously Chris won one, which year was it, 2017, where Chris won and Craig was third. And, you know, just some great moments at Stop Lines that just stand out. And you know, my job was to hopefully just allow people to experience some of the emotions that I was lucky enough to experience.
Yeah.
For me, the best was what the most emotional was Loeb. The first time he won in Haguenau, which was his home. I think it was 2000 and oh, geez, my memory now is 2008 or 9. It was his sixth victory in the championship, and it was the first time we'd been to Strasbourg for Rally France, and Haguenau was his hometown, and the final stage end was right outside the town hall, and it was beautiful, beautiful big old town hall with a tree-lined square, and there were probably 20,000 people in the square, and it was, you know, it was the one and only time I've seen it. In fact, I've seen it once or twice since, but at that point, it was the only time I'd seen Loeb showing real emotion at the end of that stop line. You know, it was somewhere that he'd grown up, he'd gone to school in Haguenau, he'd obviously spent his formative years all around that town. And the reception he got, it was like a rock star type reception from the crowd. And you know, and I've listened back occasionally to the radio coverage of that, and I think we did it justice. And it reminded me, someone asked me about it once, and I said, look, you know, I'm not one for you know, living by quotes or anything like that. But one of the quotes, I watched the documentary with Murray Walker, the great Murray Walker, who is without any question the greatest motorsport commentator there has ever been. Mm. And there have been some good motorsport commentators over the years, and there are still some very, very good ones. In Australia, you've got some of the very best, that's for sure. But Murray Walker was undoubtedly just head and shoulders above anyone. And he was once asked what the best part of his job was. And he said, just as a normal everyday bloke, he said, the greatest part of my job is standing at the shoulder of sporting giants and proclaiming their greatness to the world. And I bloody loved that. And in Haguenau that day, I felt that privilege. I felt that privilege. You're standing at the shoulder of sporting giants, and you're 5'6". Sebastian Loeb ain't no giant, but in the sporting world, he is the biggest, in the motorsport rallying world, the biggest giant, standing on his shoulder and having the privilege of proclaiming his greatness to the world. It was a lovely quote, and I felt a bit of that in Haguenau that day, just with the crowd, with the emotion from Loeb, with the enormity of what he'd achieved, you know, sixth world championship. He went on to win more, obviously. But yeah, you know, those things, you know, that's, you know, it's a big responsibility. You know, if you just stand there and mumble into the mic, and just try and describe what's going on into the mic, well, you know, that's not good enough. You know, you have to convey the emotion. You have to convey the enormity of the situation, the gravity of the situation. And that's what radio, that makes good radio. And we were good at it. You know, we were really good at it at times.
Yeah, and if, as you say, if you don't convey that passion to the listener, then how's the listener meant to know how exciting it is? So
at that point, if you'd wanted to, you just go to the splits and you watch the splits. And if that's all you want, then just go and watch the times as they come in. But you know, if you wanted to do radio, you were lucky enough to do what I did. And I never, ever, ever forget. Never mind forgot. I never forget how lucky I am. I've worked in the corporate world, as I mentioned, for 10 years, 11 years. You know, to be in the position I'm in, where, yeah, I can make a living. You know, a lot of people have got it tough just now. And I make a half-decent living out of motorsport and out of rallying. And I never, ever, ever for one second forget how lucky I am, how privileged I am to be able to do that. But, you know, part of that is because there's a little bit of talent there somewhere.
yeah, absolutely. I think the last event that Rally Radio was in when the WRC was probably Corsica in 2018, and that was after the advent of the WRC Plus or live coverage. I guess when it was clear that Rally Radio was going to end, that must have been a tough moment for you, but also for Julian and Bex and everybody else.
Well, for Bex in particular, not so much for Julian. Julian was a you know, he was still always your TV guy. He did the stage end interviews, and strangely enough, Julian Porter. I've had my ups and downs with Julian over the years. Julian is one of the very best in the world at stage ends. I don't care what anyone says about, you know, if you're an All Live fan, you'll have your opinion on Julian. But where Julian is brilliant is at stage ends, and He has lifted that job. He's clearly, for whatever reason, and I've not talked to him about it, he's finding himself back at stage ends this year. But he's brilliant. He is brilliant. He has a way of understanding drivers, asking the right questions in the right manner, being hard when he has to be hard, sympathetic only when he needs to be sympathetic. You know, if a driver's made a mistake, he doesn't let them off the hook. And he's brilliant. But yeah, that's by the by. Yeah, you know, that was difficult. Koska was difficult. And, you know, it was difficult because I wasn't sure what the future was at the time. You know, this All Live was being talked about. And All Live was happening. And I wasn't sure whether there was a place for me there or anything like that. And eventually, there was a place for me there. But it was different, Pete. It was completely different. You know, there was a one-question rule. You could only ask one question. They were downgrading the importance of stage ends, and they still do. And thank goodness Julian is back at stage ends, because, again, as I say, he appreciates what stage ends are all about. For me, I've never quite understood why the television would cut to experts, commentators, to try and work out what's happened when you have had the driver there at the stage ends, who will tell you exactly what's happened. Mm. If you give the interviewer, if you've got the right interviewer, who can read, as Julian does, read the car, read the dashboard, read the driver's faces, the co-driver's faces, read the atmosphere in the car, work out from the times. If you've got someone who can do all these things at stage ends, you can get the answers from the drivers. Why have endless nonsense speculation about what might or might not have happened when the driver is there and can tell you exactly what's happened? I've never understood that. It's just been part of a gradual downplaying of the importance of something that is utterly unique to our sport. Utterly unique. There's no other motorsport has that access or that ability.
No, and the drivers have become very good at giving an answer without giving an answer, haven't they? They really don't give any information.
Nothing. And that's because that's been allowed to happen. They know there'll be no follow-up question. They know they can give a very homogenized standard answer. And and then they can engage first gear. Most of them engage first gear before they've finished answering the question, and they're off. And it's such a shame because stage ends. It's not the be all and end all for me. It might be because that's where I obviously learned my craft. But it is an important aspect of rallying that does give us a point of difference with other sports. And when you're trying to build a sport, we have an awful, awful, awful lot of stage kilometers, which, occasionally might get a little bit boring, but stage ends never get boring. You've got the right people asking the right questions. The characters are there, characters. And we've seen it from Netflix with Drive to Survive. It's what's making certain types of sport more and more popular is the advancement of the characters within the sport. And that's what Drive to Survive has done. And that's what, at stage ends, you have the opportunity to get to know the drivers, to get to, question the characters. And unless you give a little bit of freedom to the people at the stage ends to ask those questions, to develop those lines of thinking, then, we're going to just continue to see what we're seeing now, which was drivers playing the game and understanding that we don't actually have to give this any thought. We don't have to give it any we just don't have to give it any priority whatsoever, and we'll just off we go. A couple of words and we'll go. And it's a shame. And I think we need to have a good look at that. So, thank goodness things are changing, and there's an awful lot more. People are looking a lot more closely at what we need to be doing to promote the sport of rallying. And thank goodness for Thierry Neuville. He's the man that kicked all this off in Portugal last year by having the bravery to stand up and say, no, we're not doing a good enough job here. We're really not doing a good enough job. And he kicked off a whole load of behind the scenes talks and thinking and discussion and debate stage ends are all part of that mix of how we promote our sport, and we cannot allow. I heard a ludicrous suggestion, Pete, and it was a serious suggestion, where they were going to get rid of stage end interviews altogether and just use the hot mics between the flying finish and the stop line. So they were going to just go up the cars with the hot mics. I mean, how long would it take for the drivers to understand and co-drivers? Say nothing until we're clear of the stop line. I mean, it was just ludicrous. And that came from someone very, very high up in the FIA. It wasn't his idea. He told me about it. And he was backing it. And I was saying, that's just the most ludicrous suggestion I've ever heard. Well, that's your opinion, Colin. I'm like, yeah. And I'll tell you why. Over the years, people have occasionally seen me as a little bit of a troublemaker, and I'm not a troublemaker. But what I won't do is I won't sit back and accept things that are wrong just for political expediency. I won't do it. If something's wrong, it needs to be called out. I won't make an argument just for making an argument. If I don't agree with you, I will give you a very, very, very good reason for not agreeing with you. And that's very different from someone that's just there to cause trouble. And that's not what I'm about. But I'm also not one who will be bullied into not expressing an opinion just because it doesn't suit, person A or person B's agenda.
Yes.
And unfortunately, it is the downside of a sport which is relatively small. The environment is quite a close-knit environment. You really need to be a little bit careful. And sometimes it's better to play the political game, but I can't do it. I can't do it, and I won't do it. Yeah. And I never have done it. And I'm still there after 20 years.
Well, that brings me on to one of the popular segments that you've had over the last few years, the From the Kitchen Table podcast or video segment. But that's been incredibly popular in the rally fan base, but we haven't seen that for probably 12 months or so. Tell us why.
No, it's just one of those things. I moved on from radio to a little bit of stage ends with the All Live, and I moved on to working with Dirtfish, which is the best thing. Our boss Steve Rimmer is the world's biggest rally fan, and Dirtfish has been one of the best additions to the world of rallying in terms of media and coverage that has been in the past 20 years, 25 years, without any question. And it's just kept me busy. It's just kept me ridiculously busy. And the kitchen table, I enjoy it. I basically started the kitchen table because I like to express my opinion, as you know. And the kitchen table was a great opportunity. And I thought, I can't remember what the first one was. I think it was maybe it was round about the time that Volkswagen pulled out the championship. About then, I think it maybe was.
Yeah.
I thought I want the chance to sit and talk. I don't care if no one listens to it. So I did a sitting at the kitchen table. It's a monologue. It's me talking to the camera. It's about 25 minutes long. I thought nobody's going to be silly enough to listen to this, and it got about 15,000 views on YouTube, which for something that's a monologue 25 minutes, it was like that's actually not bad.
Yeah.
Everywhere I go, people ask me about it, and they say, "When are we going to get another one?" And I feel so guilty. I feel so guilty, but it's a poor excuse. But I am just quite busy, and it's finding the time. But it's a poor excuse, and I'm not going to make it. It's a poor excuse. I am going to do more. I'm going to do more because people do want to hear opinion. They do want to hear opinion, and I did a few kind of podcast versions of it, but the great thing about something like that is you can put it on YouTube and just put it in your ear and listen to it while you're doing the shopping and all the rest, and again it's a lot of people, and I've seen a lot of people trying to do what we did with radio over the years, a lot of people trying to come in and think this media, as Pete, media takes a lot of hard work and a degree of talent and basic talent before you can actually do what's needed. Whether that be writing or photography or videography, commentary, a lot of people think, I could do that. And they can't. They can't because they haven't got the required skill set is. Sometimes it's something you can't learn. And there aren't many people who can sit for 25 minutes and talk to a camera and have people listen for all that 25 minutes. And it is a fortunate thing that I can do. And I don't know what it is, but, I seem to have a delivery style that people can listen to. And maybe it's the style, but it's probably the content as well, and that I'm not afraid to voice an opinion, and I'm certainly not afraid to give reasons. And it's, kitchen table was never about controversy and causing trouble. It did occasionally, it was occasionally controversial, but, I would always 100% back up anything I said with good reasoning. And if you can do that, people are interested and they want to know. People don't just want to hear about salacious gossip and nonsense and troublemaking. Not in sport anyway. There are plenty of other places in life where you can get that nonsense.
Of course there are.
But in sport, they want to know. They want honest opinion. They want honest, well thought through opinion. And And the kitchen table seemed to deliver that. And yeah, I need to do it more, so I'm going to.
That's all for part one of our chat with Colin Clark. We hope you enjoyed it. A reminder, subscribe to the podcast and you'll know when part two is live. Thanks to Colin for his time, and make sure you go to rallysportmag.com. All your latest rally news from Australia, New Zealand and around the world is there. Speak to you next time.